Thanks very much, Mike. I'm somewhat apprehensive about beginning, because after that, I'm sure I can only disappoint you. According to the printed program, I am to provide a legal odyssey of freedom of speech and press, which is to say, an account of what is now almost two centuries of wanderings marked by a few notable experiences and many hardships. This is not inconsistent with the instructions that were conveyed to me by phone and mail, which I interpreted to mean that I was to provide a kind of keynote address. A keynote address is supposed to be very inspiring, but to leave all the hard questions for those who follow me on the program. I doubt very much whether I can inspire you, but I shall certainly leave the hard questions for those who follow me. Another way of putting this is, I think, that I am to treat the subject of freedom of speech and press the way the Sherman Hotel in Chicago used to treat meat. During the period of which I speak, the Sherman had a restaurant in which the waiters were dressed after the fashion of Janissaries in some sultan's court and came in bearing flaming swords, at the end of which the stakes were precariously placed. I once asked the waiter there why they served the steaks on flaming swords. And I was told, well, the customers like it, and it doesn't hurt the meat. My job here today is not to hurt the meat. I can understand why the Philadelphia Society is devoting this meeting to a discussion of the First Amendment. The First Amendment, of course, is very much in the news these days, including the news this morning. Daily, some government official or another is accused of violating it. The Department of Education is said to violate it when it requires student loan applicants to disclose whether they have registered for the draft. The president violates it when, in his efforts to stop leaks to the press, he suggests that government officials take polygraph tests. Congress violates it when it tries to protect the identity of our secret agents and thereby prevent the press from impairing and impeding, that's the language of the statute, impairing or impeding CIA operations. Here, incidentally, in passing, is the American Civil Liberties Union on that subject, and I quote, "Every citizen has the right to impair and impede the functions of a government agency, whether it is the Federal Trade Commission or the CIA. Secretary Weinberger is said to have violated the First Amendment, or to have allowed his admirals and generals to violate it, when for 48 hours he did not permit the press to cover the events in Grenada. Not only did this deny the press its First Amendment right to cover military operations and deprive the people of their First Amendment right to be fully informed of military operations, but it apparently deprived the troops fighting in Grenada their First Amendment right to be covered as they are engaging in military operations. Here is ABC News President Roone Arledge on this subject, quote, "Suffice it to say that the U.S. troops on Grenada deserve as much coverage as the debate in Washington over their presence there." In short, and thanks to James Madison, America's fighting men have what might be called a constitutional right to Howard Cosell. So go the accusations, or some of them. What Justice Holmes once said of the practice of plaintiffs and respondents alike to claim that they were being denied the equal protection of the laws, he called this the usual last resort of constitutional litigants, That can now be said of the First Amendment. It pops up all over the place, and sometimes quite properly so. Unfortunately, we are not well prepared to distinguish a proper First Amendment argument from an improper one. Of course, our constitutional lawyers can tell us what the law is. They know which claims the Supreme Court has upheld and which claims the Supreme Court has not upheld. But in acknowledging the right of the court to expound the law, including the law of the Constitution, I would hesitate to say that whatever it expounds is right. I think freedom of speech is good, and I think the framers must have thought so too. Why else would they have given it constitutional protection? But one of my complaints about the court is that the court cannot tell us why it is good. Consider the 1974 case, Communist Party of Indiana against Whitcomb, which held that the Communist Party could not be kept off the ballot merely because its officers refused to sign an affidavit saying that the party did not advocate the overthrow of government by force and violence. The court ruled in favor of the Communist Party. By requiring this disclaimer oath, the court held, Indiana was burdening access to the ballot. I think that's true. It certainly was. But Article 6 of the Constitution requires state as well as federal officials to take an oath or affirmation, I'm quoting the Constitution, an oath or affirmation to support this Constitution. And could it not be said that this constitutional provision burdens access to the office itself? What is lacking in the court's First Amendment jurisprudence is an appreciation of the connection between free speech, free press, and republican government. Indeed, the prevailing view of modern theorists, I'm quoting Professor Emerson of Yale here, the prevailing view of modern theorists is that freedom of expression should be afforded all groups, even those which seek to destroy it. The classic statement of this view, I'm still quoting, is that of Justice Holmes. And Emerson then quotes Holmes's famous dissent in the Gitlow case, which goes as follows. If in the long run, the beliefs expressed in proletarian dictatorships are destined to be accepted by the dominant forces of the community, the only meaning of free speech is that they should be given their chance and have their way. That is the prevailing view, I agree. And I agree that it comes from Holmes. But it could not have been the view of James Madison and his colleagues in the First Congress when they wrote the First Amendment, nor the view of the state legislators when they voted to ratify the First Amendment and the other provisions of the Bill of Rights. Consider the implication of Holmes's principle. If in the long run, the beliefs expressed in republican government are destined to be accepted by the dominant forces of the community, that would have been all right with Madison and his colleagues. If, on the other hand, the beliefs expressed in proletarian or fascist dictatorships are destined to be accepted by the dominant forces, that too would have been all right with Madison and his colleagues. And that I don't believe. Which is to say, I don't believe the framers of the First Amendment were indifferent to the uses to which it would be put or to the consequences it would have or might have. I don't believe they thought that the only means by which government could guard against the public acceptance of anti-republican principles were education and contrary argument. Yet that is the prevailing view. Here is Justice Black in 1961 on this subject. Education and contrary argument may be sufficient to protect us from communist or fascist speech. But if that remedy is not sufficient, here he echoes Holmes, the only meaning of free speech must be that the revolutionary ideas will be allowed to prevail, which means, and I'm no longer quoting, it is worse to suppress the advocacy of Stalinism or Hitlerism than to be ruled by Stalin or Hitler. I, for one, cannot accept that, and I think the framers would not have accepted it. To them, freedom of speech and press were instruments of Republican government. In the prevailing view, however, that connection has been lost sight of. As you know, the First Amendment and the other provisions of the Bill of Rights were intended originally to limit only the national government, not the states. Among other consequences, this one had unfortunate consequences. I better start that sentence again. What I meant to say was that among other consequences, this fact had one consequence that proved unfortunate for our understanding of the meaning of freedom of speech and press. Because the federal government did not, for a long time, enact laws abridging the freedom of speech and press, or at least because the laws that might have been thought to have abridged the freedom of speech and press were not challenged in the courts, or if they were challenged in the lower courts, the cases were not appealed to the highest court. For one of these reasons, it was not until the 20th century that the Supreme Court was given the opportunity to expound the meaning of the speech and press provision of the First Amendment. Thus, to put the matter simply but somewhat dramatically, not John Marshall, a staunch friend of Republican government, but Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., an indifferent friend, or perhaps better, a casual acquaintance of Republican government, was the first justice to expound its meaning. And this, as I said, had unfortunate consequences. Because Holmes had no respect for the Constitution. As he read it, it was form without substance. It was made for people of fundamentally differing views, as he put it in his famous dissent in Lochner against New York. Whereas the framers looked upon the Constitution as an instrument to secure the rights of man, Hamilton insisted that the Constitution itself was in every respect a Bill of Rights. Holmes said there is no meaning in the rights of man except what the crowd will fight for the way a dog will fight for his bone. That's Holmes. And whereas the authors of the Declaration of Independence said it was a self-evident truth that men shared a nature or were characterized by a quality, the equal possession of unalienable rights, that this proves that no man is naturally the ruler of another man, and at the same time it also proves that every man is naturally the ruler of other animals. Nothing in the nature of things requires a man to gain the consent of his dog when he commands the dog to lie down, beg, or be quiet, or roll over. Holmes, on the other hand, in another one of his zoological metaphors, likened men to baboons. He said he saw, quote, no reason for attributing to man a significance different in kind from that which belongs to a baboon. And here is Holmes from his Abrams dissent, here on the subject of truth and free speech. To allow opposition by speech seems to indicate that you think the speech impotent, as when a man says he has squared the circle, or that you do not care wholeheartedly for the result, or that you doubt either your power or your premises. But when men have realized that time has upset many fighting faiths, they may come to believe even more than they believe the very foundations of their own conduct, that the ultimate good desired is better reached by free trade in ideas, that the best test of truth is the power of the thought to get itself accepted in the competition of the market, and that truth is the only ground upon which their wishes safely can be carried out. That, at any rate, Holmes concludes, that is the theory of our Constitution. I shall resist the temptation to comment on every aspect of this famous statement and confine myself to two remarks. First, to pointing out that his premise, truth is what the market says it is, does not support the conclusion he builds on it, which is no suppression of ideas. On what possible basis may one object if one's idea or doctrine is no longer tolerated by those who speak in the name of a, quote, truth, and are entitled, so to speak, because they won the market competition? Or to put this question more simply, where the only basis for legitimate rule is the majority, how can one object to how the majority rules? My second comment on this statement is this. It's a comment on Holmes's statement that time has upset men, many fighting faiths. That's an interesting statement. Jefferson would have agreed with it. And he also would have agreed with Holmes's conclusion that all faiths should be tolerated. As Jefferson put it, my neighbor's statement that there are 20 gods or no god neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. All faiths, all such operations of the mind, as Jefferson put it, should be tolerated because, so long as they do not produce illegal acts of the body, they are politically irrelevant. And they, religious faiths, are politically irrelevant because in the eyes of the Constitution, they are all mere opinions, and these opinions are equal insofar as they are irrelevant. The United States does not rest on, does not derive from, any one of these opinions. How do we know that these religious opinions are, these religious beliefs are mere opinions? Well, because it is a self-evident truth, or as we might say today, it is a scientific fact, that all men are endowed with the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, a happiness that they are entitled to define for themselves. If instead of being a self-evident truth, this statement of the Declaration of Independence were merely an opinion, it would be necessary to hold as legitimate, that is to say, it would be necessary to treat as legitimate, a claim of someone like Charles I, for example. He claimed to be authorized by God to force everyone, English, Scottish, and Irish alike, to worship according to the Book of Common Prayer and to recognize the authority of the Anglican Episcopacy. But we Americans know that Charles was not authorized to do this, and that no one in our own time is authorized to do this. We know it because the doing of it would deprive us of a natural right. And it is a fact, a self-evident truth, that each of us has that self, that natural right. In short, our policy of treating all religious beliefs as equal and all to be tolerated, that policy rests on our acceptance of the truth that all political beliefs are not equal. But the prevailing view of the First Amendment holds that religious and political beliefs are to be treated alike. Just as the Constitution forbids the government to decide between Anglicans and Scottish Covenanters, between Protestant and Catholic, between Christian and Jew or Muslim, between theist and atheist, so according to the prevailing view, it is equally, the Constitution is equally indifferent to political doctrines. This idea that religious and political beliefs are to be treated alike derives from the opinion that the Constitution rests on nothing at all, or rather, that it rests on no principle immune from the whims of transient majorities. Holmes was the first public official to make this assertion, and Professor Leonard Levy, in his deservedly influential book, Legacy of Suppression, Levy was the first academic forthrightly to acknowledge the principle underlying this. He said, and I quote again, freedom of speech could not become a civil liberty until the truth of men's opinions, especially their religious opinions, was regarded as relative rather than absolute. Leonard Levy. Civil liberty, as defined by Leonard Levy and all, I think, modern civil libertarians, rests on the truth that there is no truth. And this is a very weak foundation indeed. Again, consider the implications of this statement. Freedom of speech could not become a civil liberty until the truth of men's opinions was regarded as relative rather than absolute. What that means is, freedom of speech could not have been a civil liberty when this country was founded. It could not have been a civil liberty when the First Amendment was written. It could not have been a civil liberty when, in the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson and his colleagues said, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, insofar as they are all endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights." Freedom of speech and press could not become a civil liberty until a generation later, whose spokesman was Justice Holmes, had implicitly but no less effectively amended this First Amendment statement to read approximately as follows. "We hold this to be a self-evident value judgment that all opinions are equal, including the framers' opinion that men have rights, and Marx's opinion that they do not have rights, including Lincoln's opinion that all men are created equal, and Chief Justice Taney's opinion that all men are not created equal, including Washington's opinion that Jews can be good citizens of the United States, Marx's opinion that Jews were a problem to be solved by doing away with Judaism, and Hitler's opinion that Jews were a problem to be solved by doing away with Jews." A civil libertarian insists that the law treat these opinions equally, that it be neutral as to them, that there be no restrictions of any sort on the expression of these all equal opinions. Thus, Thomas Jefferson and the others at the beginning were not, according to this modern notion, and could not have been friends of civil liberty. We are told that those who would limit the freedom of speech in some way have no respect for speech and for what can be spoken. That might be true. That might also be untrue. Indeed, it is more likely to be untrue than true. Generally, is it not the case that those who would put some limits on the freedom of speech have a good deal of respect for the power of speech, for what can be accomplished by means of speech, for the consequences of speech? Is it not true that they would limit the freedom of speech in some way, to some extent, because of these consequences? Their focus is on these consequences. For example, on the possibility that a criminal defendant will not have a fair trial if the press is allowed to influence public opinion by publishing gruesome cartoons. Or, on the other hand, that a criminal defendant may not have a fair trial if a reporter, a member of the press, is allowed to withhold testimony. Or, another example, on the possibility that a military operation will be jeopardized and lives needlessly lost if the press must have advance or even simultaneous knowledge of it. on the possibility that the publication of sex will mean, as I call it, the publification of sex, which is to say the making public of that which is essentially private, with deleterious effect on the family, and therefore, if Tocqueville was right, on liberal democracy itself. Or on the possibility that innocent lives can be ruined by a slanderous press. Or on the possibility that the judicial system will be made contemptuous, ridiculous, an object of ridicule, if defendants and litigants, Larry Flint comes to mind, can with impunity speak to the judges as they speak to their sexual partners, their zipless sexual partners. Or on the possibility that by allowing the Nazis to march in Skokie, Illinois, the Nazis will come to be regarded as a legitimate political party. Or, finally, on the possibility that under some circumstances, some political speakers may have an advantage over other political speakers, that the speaker at one end of the street who shouts, "Workers of the world, unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains," as well as the speaker at the other end of the street, the opposite end of the street, the one who shouts, "Ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer," that these two speakers will somehow, under some conditions, have an advantage over the speaker in the middle, say, Hubert Horatio Humphrey, or as President Carter called him, Hubert Horatio Hornblower, who in the middle of the block shouts out, "Folks, I want to tell you something about Medicare." Under some circumstances, that Marxist at the one end and that Nazi at the other would seem to have an advantage. The issue is whether the law, after doing its best to guard against prejudice, to guard against bigotry, to guard against prudery, to guard against all the other vicious possibilities prosecutors, judges, and juries sometimes display, whether the law may not take these consequences or the possibility of them into account. The prevailing view is, on the whole, that the law may not do this. The original view, the view of those who wrote the First Amendment and who governed the country at the beginning, their view was that the law may take these consequences into account. Evidence? Here's Thomas Jefferson. "While we deny that Congress have a right to control the freedom of the press, we have ever asserted the right of the states and their exclusive right to do so." His objection to the sedition law, and this comment was made in a letter to Abigail Adams, John Adams's wife, having to do with the sedition law. His objection to that sedition law of 1798 was only that it was enacted by the national government. Madison's position was the same. James Wilson, the other principal founder during the, well, Madison's closest colleague probably in the debates in Philadelphia in 1787, Wilson said liberty of the press meant no more than the absence of prior restraint. Hamilton thought the alien sedition laws imprudent, but nevertheless constitutional. That was also John Marshall's view. Indeed, there can be no disputing what I'm saying here. Leonard Levy has agreed with it, which is why he entitles his book, Legacy of Suppression. The framers, these men, Madison, Jefferson, Wilson, and the others, left us a legacy of suppression in his view, as he defines suppression. They were not, as he sees it, civil libertarians. Better, I think, to say that the framers left us a constitutional provision and a body of principle in the light of which to interpret that provision. It is an unfortunate fact that they left us little by way of interpretation or explication. For example, during the debates in the First Congress on the Bill of Rights, there was a good deal of discussion of freedom of religion. And the constitutional words best suited to protect the freedom of religion. There was debate on that, a good deal of discussion. And from that discussion, we can learn how they would have decided cases involving the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. But there was no discussion whatever of freedom of speech and press. Apparently, everyone was for it, and nobody thought it necessary to specify what he was for. My own view is that they had to be for freedom to express criticism of the government, as well as criticism of government officials. I think that much can be deduced from the principle that just government rests on the consent of the governed, which reasonably can mean the informed consent of the governed. American government may arise out of self-interested calculation. I refer here to the Declaration of Independence. To secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, which means that it is in order to secure one's own individual rights that a person yields his natural powers and natural freedoms to civil society and ultimately to a government. But the persons who agree to do this may not always know in what their interest consists, or may not always know the best way to advance that interest. The Declaration of Independence assumes that they who enter into this contract are rational beings, capable of learning where their true interest lies. To use Tocqueville's formulation, they are capable of self-interest rightly understood, which is to say, capable of rightly understanding their self-interest. In this respect, they are unlike Holmes's baboons, who, lacking rational faculties, are incapable of acting morally or immorally. Speech, whether oral or written, is addressed to this uniquely human faculty, rationality. And within generous boundaries, it must have been speech in this sense that the authors of the First Amendment intended to protect. Why, according to the framers, is free speech good? Because it is a necessary means of men coming rightly to understand their self-interest and their collective interest. What I am saying here is that we are capable of learning something of the framers' intention for the First Amendment by noting the fact that they used the word speech, that they did not use the word expression. The First Amendment speaks of freedom of speech, not freedom of expression. And it is noteworthy that the word favored by those holding the prevailing view is indeed expression. Here again is Yale professor Emerson on this. In construing specific legal doctrines which will govern concrete issues, the main function of the courts is not to balance the interest in freedom of expression against other social interests, but to define the key elements in the First Amendment, quote, expression, quote, abridge, quote, law. Emerson, inadvertently no doubt, removes the word speech from the First Amendment and replaces it with the word expression, which is wholly compatible with the sort of gestures and utterances and expletives and biological functions he would have the First Amendment protect. The difference between speech and expression as elements in First Amendment law is similar to the difference often noted by the framers, the difference between liberty and licentiousness. the framers were in favor of the one and were opposed to the other. The difficulty, and here one appreciates the position of modern civil libertarians, the difficulty comes not simply in distinguishing one from the other, but in devising rules of law that allow the distinction to be made. Alexander Hamilton, as consul in the Croswell case of 1804, was one of the first Americans to wrestle with this particular problem. Croswell was a Federalist newspaper editor in Westchester County. He accused Jefferson of paying James Callender, one of the more notorious calumniators of that particular day. Croswell accused Jefferson of paying Callender for calling Washington a traitor, robber, and perjurer, and for calling John Adams a hoary-headed incendiary. Croswell was indicted, let's say he was charged with a criminal offense. Speech was regarded as having criminal aspects under the law of New York at that time. And Croswell defended himself by saying that what he had printed was true. And in a certain respect, it certainly was. Jefferson had paid Callender to attack Washington and Adams. Under New York law, however, at that time, and the law was still in essential respects the English common law, truth was not a defense. And since Fox's Libel Act of 1792 did not affect New York law, but only British law, the role of the jury was limited to deciding whether Croswell had indeed published what he was accused of having published, and whether the state of New York was correct in thinking that these particular words, traitor, robber, perjurer, hoary-headed incendiary, were, to put it simply, were opprobrious. Croswell was convicted, and Hamilton came into the case when it was appealed, and he took over Croswell's defense. And my point of mentioning this is that Hamilton, in the course of defending, unsuccessfully in this particular case, as it turned out, defending Croswell, was responsible more than anybody else, I think, for reforming, and properly reforming, the law of criminal libel in the United States. And clearly, that law had to be reformed. The principle of the common law, the law that New York operated under up until this time, that principle was the greater the truth, the greater the libel. That principle simply could not be accepted in a Republican regime. So truth, provided it was published with good motives and for justifiable ends, became an adequate defense. Secondly, in a Republican regime, the jury could not be excluded, as it was in Britain, up until Fox's Libel Act especially, the jury could not be excluded from determining the truth, from determining the good motives, and for determining justifiable ends. And thanks largely to Hamilton, this became the law of New York, and from New York that law spread to other states. A law whose purpose is to distinguish between liberty and licentiousness, and a law that gives the jury a greater role in making this distinction. Can juries be trusted with it? If not, the distinction may have to be abandoned, and the modern civil libertarians favor its abandonment. The same analysis can be made of censorship law. Got to say, what I've said here with respect to libel and slander can also be said of censorship law. A strong case can be made against a law allowing a judge alone, to decide that this book may be banned because it is obscene, and beyond that, this book has no literary merit, and that book may not be banned either because it is not obscene or because, while obscene, it has literary merit. A strong case, as I say, can be made against authorizing a judge to make these decisions, authorizing a judge alone. In principle, at least, John Milton made that case against giving the judge this kind of power, in principle, as I say. On the other hand, perhaps an equally strong case can be made against a law that allows a jury to make these decisions. In principle, at least, John Stuart Mill made this case. Do we then conclude that we should abandon the effort to draw a legal distinction between liberty and licentiousness in this area too? The civil libertarians would abandon it. One has to wonder, however, whether by abandoning the effort in all the areas of the First Amendment to distinguish between liberty and licentiousness, which is to say, abolishing a First Amendment law that allows us to weigh the consequences of speech and to evaluate those consequences, whether by judge or jury, one has to wonder whether we would also be abandoning the cause of free. Consists, in part, in maintaining, as part of public opinion, a correct understanding of the founding principles. In this respect, we today are fortunate that when the meaning of the Declaration of Independence was being publicly debated during the Civil War or prior to the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln was alive and well. It is our misfortune, I think, that when the meaning of freedom of speech and press had to be decided by the Supreme Court, John Marshall was not alive and well. I can only speculate as to how he would have written the opinion for the court in Schenck, Abrams, Gitlow, Fannie Hill, Cohn against California, New York Times against Sullivan. I can only speculate as to how he would have written those opinions, but I am fairly certain his opinions would not have resembled, not closely, those written by Oliver Wendell Holmes, Hugo Black, William Brennan, or William O. Douglas. Marshall would have distinguished between speech and expression. He would have distinguished between liberty and licentiousness. He would have devised rules governing how the distinction ought to be made. He would have instructed us on the importance in a republican regime of maintaining the distinction. And in addition, he would have instructed us, he would have cautioned us to do all this with a generous heart and a tolerant spirit. And we are in need, I think, today of all this instruction. Well, as I said at the beginning, I was fairly certain I would not inspire you, but I was absolutely confident that I would leave all the hard questions for those who follow me on this program. And with that, I shall sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, Walter. We have now time for some questions, if Professor Burns is willing to answer some. Would you kindly state your name and then your question? Thank you.
Jeremy, you don't get any. Yes, sir.
Yeah, Eugene Meyer, that's my name. I was wondering, with the situation which we have today where agreed values in the country of some degree disintegrate, given that condition, is there a way to limit free speech without having a problem with that? What the papers that have been discussed, that is, essentially becomes a matter of a specific political agenda rather than trying to
Yeah, let's assume that your premise is correct. That's, to put it as I would put it, how many Americans today would say with Jefferson that we hold this to be self-evident, et cetera, et cetera. Assuming that to be correct, the question is, Why is that so? And to some extent in the public law of the country, it is so because of Holmes and so forth and so on. But lurking behind that, of course, there have been profound developments in the area of political philosophy, where the thought that lay behind or that lies behind Jefferson's statement in the Declaration of Independence, that thought has been severely attacked by others, beginning even before Jefferson stated it, and moving through the 19th century and so forth and so on. And we are today the heirs of that, and we have to live with it somehow. But the question you raise, Mr. Myers, really is the question, to what extent is it possible in our day and age